You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. I'm Eric Newman, the news director here at JPR.
I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
And I'm Jane Vaughn. I'm the housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
Justin Higginbottom, our other reporter, is out this week, but we recently published his look at drinking water contamination and mobile home parks in Northern California. Here's a conversation he had yesterday with Roman.
Hey there, Justin.
Hey, Roman.
So you reported on PFAS contamination in drinking water for some communities in Northern California. First, can you tell us what that chemical is and what you found there?
Yeah, so I found that some residents at mobile home parks in Northern California have been drinking PFAS contaminated water for years, and without knowing it in some cases, even though there's a law in place so that they are notified about that. So first, PFAS, they're man-made chemicals. They're used to make cleaning products and clothing, cookware. There's actually thousands of different kinds. And they're sometimes called a forever chemical because they don't break down naturally. They stick around. That's an issue because they've also been linked to health impacts, a bunch of health impacts. They can affect fertility and your immune system. The chemical has even been linked to cancer. California has been actually monitoring PFAS in drinking water at a selection of locations. And they chose locations in the state where they thought they might find the chemical, like places near industrial sites or landfills. And the state's been, they've been relatively ahead of the curve in thinking at least about this chemical compared to a lot of the country. There was legislation passed in the state in 2019 that basically says if certain PFAS reach high enough levels at those monitored locations, then residents need to be notified. They need to be told what they're drinking, or the well or water system needs to be treated or shut down. And so a couple mobile home parks in our coverage area, one in Red Bluff and one in Crescent City, had high enough levels, had these really high levels of PFAS that should require at least residents be notified.
Yeah, wow. So what did you find then when you visited these mobile home parks?
So a resident in Red Bluff said she was first told about the contamination in March of this year, but that location has actually had high levels for at least 4 years. That's what we found looking at public data. And that's when the state started monitoring it. It's nearby an industrial site with really high PFAS contamination, and we know this chemical can migrate in groundwater. Another resident in Crescent City had no idea her tap water had high levels of PFAS, even though public data, again, shows the site having contamination for years. And this matters. It's important because even though you probably wouldn't see health impacts of drinking that contaminated water right away, it builds up in your body over time, like I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, clearly we're finding these high levels of PFAS in these mobile home or RV parks. What makes them susceptible to this kind of contamination?
Yeah, so I spoke with a PFAS researcher at the Natural Resources Defense Council. That's an environmental nonprofit. And she said that they found low-income residents to have relatively high levels of PFAS contamination in California in a study they did. And that's probably because, the properties where those residents live are more likely to be near sources of PFAS, like industrial sites or landfills where just the property prices tend to be a bit cheaper. And that likely doesn't just apply to California, where the study took place, but probably across the country.
Yeah, so we might be seeing this across the country, but may not know because there isn't as much monitoring. I know that the EPA recently made a new rule about PFAS. What is that rule and how does it affect these small water systems?
So this is the first national PFAS drinking water rule, and it sets a maximum contaminant level for certain kinds of PFAS, and that's a legally enforceable limit for the chemical. So it says that public water systems have 3 years to test for the chemicals, a few of the chemicals at least, and 5 years to lower PFAS levels in their water if they're found to be over the maximum contaminant level. And just to be clear, the residents at these mobile home parks that I went to, they had more than double that maximum contaminant level for PFOA. That's one of the PFAS chemicals. Around $1 billion in federal funding will be available to treat water systems with contamination, but it's going to be just a massive undertaking. I spoke with someone at UCLA who studies small water systems like wells at mobile home parks, And he says in general, the water quality there can be bad, but treating for PFAS is pretty expensive. And these small water systems, they just don't always have the resources to do that, or the economies of scale to make that efficient, for it to make sense. Or sometimes, you know, they can't even connect with larger water systems to bring down that PFAS contamination level. So in the coming years, we'll get a better sense of how prevalent PFAS contamination is in the country as more sites test. And then also we'll get a better sense of what it's really going to take to address this issue.
Great. Well, thank you, Justin.
Thanks, Herman.
Jane, you published a feature this week about ballot measures in Josephine and Jackson counties. Let's start with Josephine County. What's going on there?
So they have a proposal to create a new charter for the county. The group behind this charter is called the Citizens for Responsible Government. They're a nonpartisan group. And there's a lot of different changes they're proposing in this charter, so I'll run through a couple of them. One of them is increasing the number of people on the Board of Commissioners from 3 to 5. They want to elect the commissioners from newly designed districts rather than countywide. So there would be 4 districts and 1 countywide seat rather than right now. There's 3 countywide seats. And they also want to hire a county manager, which they don't currently have. They want to impose term limits for the county commissioners. They want to make the elections for all the county offices nonpartisan. And they want to pay the commissioners a smaller stipend instead of their current salary and benefits. That stipend would be about $26,000. So they claim that this new proposed charter would have better representation for voters in the county, more accountability, better efficiency, better effectiveness. And the county had a 2-year charter commission that had ended its work last spring, and their job was to review the charter, and they came up with a bunch of recommendations. And so this group, Citizens for Responsible Government, says that they built their proposed charter based off of some of those recommendations.
Okay. And so what does the opposition say about this proposal in Josephine County?
So there's been some pushback from Republicans in the county, and that includes some of the current commissioners, including Herman Bertschiger and John West. There's also a political action committee called We're for a Constitutional Government. I talked with Jonathan Knapp, who's with the Josephine County Republican Party. He says that he doesn't like that the proposed charter would increase the size of the government because there'd be more commissioners and a manager. Mm-hmm. And he also thinks that it would hurt rural candidates who are trying to get elected. So right now, as I said, everyone in the county can vote for all 3 of the commissioners because it's countywide. But under the new system, you would only vote for the commissioner within your district as well as the countywide seat. Mm. And so Jonathan Knapp was saying that he thinks that that would hurt rural candidates who are maybe trying to get elected in a certain district. Another argument that the opponents have is that each of the proposed districts includes part of Grants Pass. And so their fear is that the commissioners could all be from the city of Grants Pass, which is true, but that's also true of the current system as well because it's countywide. And so it seems like most of the commissioners right now are from Grants Pass anyways, or at least historically. So that's not actually changing that much.
Okay. So that's the Josephine County proposal. There's also Jackson County proposals. What's happening there?
So there are 3 sort of similar measures on the ballot. They're broken up into 3 ballot measures rather than 1 new charter. And the group behind those measures in Jackson County is called Jackson County for All of Us, another nonpartisan group. They want to increase the number of commissioners from 3 to 5, make them nonpartisan, and reduce their salaries to $75,000. Their salaries were recently increased, or at least approved by the county's budget committee, approved an increase in April, and so 2 of them will make over $150,000. One of them will make about $136,000. The budget still has to be approved, but that increase was approved by the county's budget committee. And so Jackson County, for All of Us, is proposing reducing those salaries down to $75,000. And again, they claim that these ballot measures will create better representation for the county. They don't think the commissioners need to be paid that much money. They think this will offer more better perspective with more commissioners, better transparency. And one of their goals is also to allow non-affiliated voters to participate in the primary election. They're the biggest voting group in Jackson County. They currently can't vote for major party candidates in the primary. But if the commissioners were nonpartisan, then these non-affiliated voters could participate as well in the primary.
Okay. And so what is the opposition saying about this Jackson County proposal?
Again, it's local Republicans mostly. So that includes the current commissioners, Rick Dyer, Colleen Roberts. There's a political action committee called Stop Bigger government, which has raised more than $20,000 to oppose these measures. They have signs all over the county, you might have seen. I talked with Randall Embertson, who's the chairman of the Jackson County Republican Party, and he says basically he doesn't see a reason to make these changes. He thinks Jackson County is being run really well as it is. He also said he would rather see the commissioners stay partisan because he said there's important philosophical viewpoints that come with being a Democrat or Republican, and if you're nonpartisan, then your constituents won't actually know how you're going to vote. There's also a concern from the opposition that this could cost the county money. The county administrator, Danny Jordan, has said that these measures would cost the county between $200,000, potentially $700,000. The group behind these measures, Jackson County for All of Us, says that presentation is inaccurate, but that's one of the concerns that the opposition has in Jackson County.
Okay, thanks, Jane.
Thank you.
There's more detailed information on our website about these different ballot measures. Ballots are out now. The deadline to submit them is May 21st. Roman, we're going to turn to you now. There was recent news out of Shasta County about the elections manager. The county clerk, Kathy Darling Allen, recently retired after serving for the past 20 years or so. It's kind of a local position, but that's important because Shasta County has probably been the most politically divisive community in our coverage area down here. Kathy Darling Allen has kind of been the person who's kept elections going, essentially, in Shasta County. So everyone was curious who would replace her. What happened this past week?
Yeah, so according to California law, her replacement is appointed by the Board of Supervisors. The county clerk is normally an elected position. She most recently won re-election in 2022, but there aren't rules about holding a special election to fill her seat. So they're basically going to appoint a replacement to fill out the rest of her term through 2026. This is really important because the relationship between Kathy and the far-right supervisors that control the board has not been the best. You know, they've gotten into public fights during meetings while she's tried to defend the county's election system. Last year, these supervisors tried to force the county to hand count ballots, which is just a more expensive, more time-consuming, less accurate than using the machines that Kathy Darling Allen supports. And she fought hard against that. She got a state law passed to ban hand counting throughout the state. So those same far-right supervisors that have fought against her will be picking her replacement to oversee the next two major elections.
Okay. So it sounds like they're taking an unusual approach in terms of the qualifications applicants have to have. How are these folks going to be interviewed?
Yeah, so typically when appointing elected positions like this, they'll either directly appoint a replacement, like the next person in line, maybe the assistant, or they'll form a committee and with a couple of the higher-ups, including supervisors, this county CEO, they'll go through applications, determine some minimum qualifications, and then they'll pick out some finalists that'll be interviewed by the Board of Supervisors in a closed-door meeting. But they threw all of that out the window this time, which was kind of surprising to me too. Instead, they're not going to have a committee beforehand to pick out finalists. Everyone who applies will be interviewed by the supervisors. And what's most unique is these interviews will all happen in the public in an open meeting. You know, I haven't really seen this process happen before. I'm sure it's probably happened somewhere. They're also doing away with the requirements, with any minimum requirements other than what's required to normally get elected to this position. So you just have to be a registered voter in Shasta County at the time of your appointment, not before you apply. You can still be interviewed and not be registered, and you can't have ties to collections agencies, essentially. So that means that anyone who applies pretty much will be interviewed in public by the Board of the Supervisors, even if they're not a good fit for the position. Supervisor Patrick Jones says he doesn't expect a lot of people to apply, but I wouldn't be surprised if we saw some, you know, a significant amount of people, but we'll kind of see what that looks like.
Okay. That sounds like it could be a pretty chaotic process depending on who applies. You've watched lots of public meetings based in Shasta County. What are you expecting as candidates are interviewed for the job of county clerk?
Yeah, I feel like it could end up getting pretty messy. It depends on how many people we see apply. There's also some privacy concerns with this public interview process. One of the supervisors mentioned the risk of backlash from a current employer. You know, if you apply and you're interviewed in public, everyone's going to know that you're trying to apply for another job, and that might not look good if you don't get the job. I'm also trying to confirm this with the county PIO, but according to him in an email, he had said all applications and information submitted with the applications will be a matter of public record. So meaning everything you submit in your application will be publicly available. And when I looked at the application, there's a lot of information in there that you probably don't want to be public public, like your home address, telephone number, birth date, email, and most concerning, the last four digits of your social security number. So I'm trying to confirm if that's actually the case, if that will all be public. I'm not sure if that's really safe. I've been looking into applying myself just to see how the process works, but I don't really want to give out that information right now to the public. We know a couple of people who will apply, like the assistant county clerk. The application is going to close on June 7th, and the interviews will take place on the 17th.
Okay, I can hear the music, so that's going to do it for the debrief this week. Thanks, everybody. And thank you for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things that we should cover in the future through our news tip line. You can find that on our website at ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.